From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As the U.S. and the Soviet Union talk about peace, dictators, terrorists, and drug traffickers are arming themselves with sophisticated weapons. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the new arms race and the international arms business with James Adams, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. Also today, we meet actor Tim Robbins. He played a befuddled pitcher in Bull Durham. Now he's playing a befuddled criminal in the new comedy Cadillac Man. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles blues legend Sonny Boy Williamson. And commentator Patricia McLaughlin tells us about her garden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There's reported to be rioting at this moment on Fulton Street in Brooklyn in response to the latest verdict in the Bensonhurst racial killing. Keith Mondello, the accused instigator of the killing, was acquitted today of murder and manslaughter charges. The jury convicted Mondello on lesser charges of riot, unlawful imprisonment, discrimination, menacing, and criminal possession of a weapon. The verdict was delivered in the 11th day of deliberations by the Mondello jury. Reporter Jim Zeroli describes the scene in the courtroom as the verdict was delivered.
There was a really tumultuous response when the verdict was announced. A lot of the people in the Yusuf Hawkins aisle, that is the aisle that, in which his family and friends sit, began screaming and yelling, and one man tried to get up in the middle of the verdict reading and walk out, and there was a lot of commotion. A lot of guards stood up and tried to contain the crowd.
Jim Zeroli at the courtroom in Brooklyn. Officials in New York City announced today that tests have failed to link any of a group of teenage suspects to the gang rape of a woman jogger in Central Park. Genetic tests performed on the semen-stained sock belonging to the woman failed to match the DNA profiles of any of the defendants. Six youths have been indicted on rape and attempted murder charges in the rape and beating of the woman, a Wall Street investment banker. Prosecutors say the negative test results will mean their case will rely almost exclusively on witness testimony and the suspect's videotaped and written confessions. House and Senate negotiators are all but finished with a package of aid to Nicaragua and Panama, one that President Bush has been calling for several weeks. One final action, though, won't come until next week. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
President Bush called for $800 million to assist the two Central American countries in their transitions to true democracies. And though some in Congress object to sending so much money to such small nations, the problem with the package has had nothing to do with the actual aid plan. Instead, because it is a spending bill, various members of Congress tacked on all kinds of other items. The most contentious of these was a measure funding the District of Columbia, which contained controversial language on abortion. Now the Congress has agreed not to include that provision, and the aid package should move easily through the Congress and to the president's desk next week. Still to be settled, however, just where the defense budget will be cut to pay for the Central American aid. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Prices on the New York Stock Exchange retreated somewhat today after yesterday's rise to a record high. Investors were said to be waiting for positive signs that interest rates won't go up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 13 points to close at 2,819.19. Advances barely edged declines in active trading of 163 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. The trustees of a women's college in California voted today to reverse a decision to begin admitting male undergraduates. The decision is a victory for students at Mills College in Oakland. The 138-year-old college admits male graduate students, but the prospect of a co-educational undergraduate program prompted strikes and protests on campus. The Board of Trustees made the decision to admit males in an effort to boost declining enrollment. Students ended their two-week-old strike yesterday, and most went home for the summer. This morning, about 200 remained to await the vote results. Flooding continues along the Missouri River, which has crested at Jefferson City and Herman, Missouri, and is expected to crest in St. Louis tomorrow. Kathy Lohr has details.
About 100 residents residents were evacuated near Jefferson City, where the river crested 7.5 feet above flood stage today. More than 250 inmates have also been evacuated from a women's correctional center in the same area. And three highways are closed near Herman, Missouri, where the river crested 12 feet above flood level. The Missouri governor has declared Jackson County and Kansas City a disaster area. Preliminary estimates show at least $5 million in property damage there, but there's no estimate yet on the amount of flood damage statewide. The Missouri, Mississippi, and Merrimack rivers are expected to crest in the St. Louis area tomorrow. Officials say only minor flood damage is expected here if the state can escape large amounts of rainfall, but the forecast is calling for more rain over the weekend. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
A recount has been ordered in this week's race for the presidency of the Dominican Republic. The country's Central Election Board called for the recount as the official vote count went into its third day amid charges of vote fraud from the opposition candidate. Challenger Juan Bosch withdrew a threat to lead street demonstrations against incumbent Joaquin Balaguer. Balaguer, who's 83 and blind, has served 5 terms as president. This is his 5th race with Bosch. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union may be winding down, but my guest James Adams warns there's a new arms race underway. As the superpowers begin laying down their arms, the developing nations are picking them up. Adams says developing nations want weapons as a symbol of power and authority, and they need weapons to fight regional wars. Weapons are in the hands of dictators, and through the black market, weapons are also going to terrorists and drug traffickers. James Adams is the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, where he's also an associate editor. His new book is called Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. According to Adams, the arms business changed dramatically during the past decade.
What is different, I think, about the last decade of this century is that you've got weapons of mass destruction, and traditionally that has meant to us nuclear weapons, but this is different, chemical, biological weapons, which are readily available through technology transfer and because they're easy to make, by and large. You have developing countries who've got access to that kind of equipment, which was never possible really before. And the worrying thing is, of course, that they not only have access to that kind of equipment, but they have delivery systems, missiles, particularly ballistic missiles, that can get them from the point of origin to the point of destination with ease, and against which there is no real defense. So it's a completely different problem, and the scale of it is unimaginable, really. Chemical weapons or biological weapons can be just absolutely devastating in their effect, and we've seen in Iran, Iraq, and elsewhere that countries are all too ready to use them if they have them, unlike nuclear weapons, which, of course, have not really been used.
Which countries are the leading suppliers in the new arms race, and what's the balance between it being supplied by governments and being supplied through the black market?
Well, I think you go into a definitional problem to some extent on actually who supplies it, because the black market traditionally means, I think, illegal supplies of weapons. And, of course, there are the arms dealers who do that. But there is the sort of gray market where countries say, we will not supply equipment X to any countries in area Y, but then secretly do so. And the grey market is an enormous and growing market. And the countries that are exploiting it are not just countries like Germany, let's say, or Switzerland or Sweden, but newcomers to the arms market who have grown up in the last decade. Countries like Brazil, North Korea, South Africa, which is now a major arms exporter, Israel also. So these are new nations where there weren't traditionally the arms business was left to the very industrialized nations who had a measure of control, I suppose. But the new competitiveness in the market is not only drives down prices and gives countries who want weapons a number of places where they can go to buy them, but makes those weapons readily accessible to places where before it would have been much more difficult for the arms to get. So it's a different world really now than 1990 compared with 1980 is really been transformed.
My guest is James Adams. He's the defense correspondent of the Sunday Times of London and author of the new book, Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. You say that the Iran-Iraq war helped change the arms business, in part because it was such a big market, but also because there were new cheap weapons that were in demand there. This created a new market at a time when the arms market was declining?
Yes, I think that that's right. Or it would be fairer to say created a new market at a time when the traditional arms suppliers were finding it difficult to meet previous levels of arms supplies. But what the Iran-Iraq war did was create a market which hadn't really existed before, and it was a huge market, a scale of unimaginable size, really, where both sides over 8 or 9 years spent around $500 billion, not just on arms, but on the war. And so countries that previously would not have had an outlet or indeed a reason for going into the arms business because they'd figure, well, we won't be able to sell what we produce, rushed to feed at the trough. So you had countries like Brazil, which at the beginning of the war were really negligible players in the arms field, South Africa the same, who produced a very wide range of weapons. So South Africa that started the war, started the Iran-Iraq war, dependent almost entirely on outside suppliers, ended the war self-sufficient in everything except for sophisticated modern jet fighters. And that was an extraordinary change of power and of influence that I don't think could have happened under any other circumstances and has changed the whole arms market forever.
Well, 28 countries supplied both Iran and Iraq. The United States, France, China, South Africa, West Germany are just a few of those 28 countries. What do you think some of the consequences have been? Have there been consequences of 28 countries having supplied both sides?
Well, no, I don't think so, really, because we would like to think, perhaps, that this example of blatant hypocrisy where countries sign up to boycotts and then not only ignore it by sponsoring one side, but totally ignore it by sponsoring both sides, one would like to think that some sanction would result. But it's a measure, I think, of the realpolitik of the arms business that no one really seems to mind terribly much. And there are the ritual noises of protest made here and there, but there isn't any sanctions in the sense of a country is banned from being a member of this group or that group or is ostracized by other countries. Instead, it is isn't this rather unfortunate, and people move on to other things. And it certainly doesn't mean that a country, having supplied both sides, is then banned from the arms fair in Singapore this year. Quite the reverse. It's done rather well and will advertise its arms as having been proven in combat. So it hopes that it will generate more sales and probably will do so, in fact.
Iraq is trying to become a nuclear power, and they are allegedly building a super gun, a gun that would be able to fire both chemical and nuclear weapons. The person who is believed to have been the designer of this record was recently murdered. His name was Gerald Bull. Italy recently seized 90 tons of steel parts that were suspected to be part of the super gun design. Do you have any information, inside information, on the development of the super gun?
Well, Jerry Bull is an interesting guy, actually, because he was originally, he set up a company called Space Research Corporation, which was based on the border between Canada and the United States. And his original plan was to put cheap satellites in space using this enormous gun, 118 feet long. And he test-fired it using a site in the Caribbean. Now, he was originally operating with the covert support of the U.S. government. Many believe that it was the CIA who originally funded Dr. Bull, and he then fell out with them and went off on his own way, but not before he had developed a super cannon, a particular type of weapon, a 155mm with a new type of ammunition that he then passed to Israel, which in turn passed the technology to South Africa. South Africa has built the weapon known as the G5 and has sold it to Iran in exchange for oil, has used it in Angola, and South Africa has developed perhaps the most effective mobile artillery system in use in the world today, courtesy of Dr. Bull. And he has supplied weapons to Iraq also. And then, as you mentioned, the super gun. And he was assassinated, many believe, by Israeli intelligence before the Iraqis managed to get all the equipment in hand. But he's had a very interesting career, both on the legal and covert arms market and on the illegal market, and has been a major player for some time until he was shot a couple of months ago.
Do you think that there's any way to stop new countries like Iraq from developing nuclear weapons?
I think it's extremely difficult, which is a very sort of dumb answer. But the countries that have developed nuclear weapons recently, Israel, South Africa perhaps, Pakistan, certainly very close to it now, Iraq a few years off, but proceeding along that path quite happily. All those countries have been known to be developing nuclear weapons, and other countries have, the United States or the Soviet Union or Britain or France or whomever, have signed up and said, this must stop. But at the end of the day, there are always reasons why one country or another will not hold the line and bypass the boycott that people have agreed to. So in the case of Pakistan, for example, the United States has absolutely hard, certain intelligence that Pakistan is developing nuclear weapons, that that work has proceeded, that despite Congress needing, wanting a mandate from the president that they are not developing nuclear weapons, the president keeps saying, well, they're not really, and we're not absolutely 100% sure, which is twisting the truth, to be polite about it. They do not stand and say, if Pakistan does this, we will cut off all aid to Pakistan. Instead, they say, OK, well, we don't really think it's happening, because Pakistan was needed for the United States in supplying weapons to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So it's that kind of realpolitik that always undercuts, or seems to always undercut, efforts to stop proliferation, whether it be of nuclear or chemical or even simple conventional arms.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is James Adams, and his new book is called Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest James Adams is the defense correspondent at the Sunday Times of London, where he's also an associate editor. In your new book, Engines of War, you paint a picture of the arms race and the drug trade growing together side by side, feeding off of each other. How do they feed off of each other?
Well, if you take, for example, Afghanistan, where the supply of equipment, military equipment to the Mujahideen was at a level unprecedented in modern times for a guerrilla war. And you take the people who the equipment was being supplied to, you have the Mujahideen are portrayed as being heroic resistance fighters, which indeed they were, very brave people. But they're also not exactly the most honest group of people you could imagine. And they saw opportunities to make a lot of money. One of the traditional ways of making cash out there is through growing opium. And so they traded much of the weapons that they had, which was a way of making money. And they then plowed that back into the economy in terms of cultivating more land, grew opium, converted it into heroin, and then shipped it, 80% of it, to the United States. So it was a strange cycle of arms for cash, for drugs, all of beginning and ending with the United States, which is a price that the U.S. is only beginning to realize it's having to pay for the support of that war.
Weren't drugs also used to buy arms?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, the PLO have been involved in that for a long time. The drug barons in Colombia use drug money, of course, to equip their private armies. But you would generally find that the drugs generates the cash which buys the weapons, rather than the weapons generating the cash which buys the drugs, because drugs are the profit margins on drugs are far higher than they are on arms.
Well, drug dealers are becoming big users of weapons now. I mean, two Colombian drug dealers believed to be working for the Medellin cartel were arrested trying to purchase 120 Stinger missiles and other military hardware in Florida recently. And the belief is that they were going to use these weapons against the government before the May 27th presidential elections. Is this an example? Go ahead.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, you're bound to have, where you're generating substantial sums of money and you're generating it illegally, and the money is just so enormous that one can hardly imagine the scale of it, then what you're going to do to protect your investment, which is happens to be in drugs, but it could be, I suppose, in anything, then you're going to buy arms to fuel it. And you have enough money that you can buy just about any arms you like. Now, clearly, in the case of Colombia, there's not much point in buying M48 tanks or anything. What you want is stuff that is very effective, high technology, high power, and gives you a lot of street credibility. Stinger missiles do that very precisely. So there is enough around to buy pretty much whatever you want, and the drug dealers around the world tend to have the cash in a way that really no one else has.
Where do the independent arms dealers get their arms from?
Oh, well, there's no shortage of suppliers. You could go from the arms bazaar in Peshawar in Pakistan on the border with Afghanistan. You can go to the Eastern Bloc, where traditionally both the military, senior military figures and senior political figures have made a great deal of money on the private arms market. And then you can go to other dealers like Monza Al-Khazar, perhaps the most significant illegal arms dealer in the world, who buys his weapons say he bought a year's supply of Star pistols from the Spanish government and stored them in a warehouse in Spain and then sold them to anyone who wanted to buy them. Or you go to South Africa, who doesn't care who they sell their arms to. They're not worried whether a man is operating on behalf of a terrorist or a country, as long as they get good foreign currency for the weapons that they produce. It is only in countries like the United States and Britain where there is supposed to be a conscience attached to a rifle. For many countries, there is no regard for the end user, merely a need for cash.
Which are the countries whose economies are most dependent on arms sales?
Well, for many countries, like Britain, for example, generates several billion pounds a year from the arms business, and that is good foreign currency that comes in and has a significant effect on the balance of payments and employs, the arms industry in Britain employs over 100,000 people. Perhaps 500,000 people are employed in arms-related businesses. So it's a very significant impact on an industrial country like the United Kingdom. In a country like South Africa, where they're desperate for foreign exchange, it has a much more significant impact, because for every weapon they sell abroad, that is currency that they would not otherwise be able to obtain. And no one, they produce all sorts of equipment under license, much of it from Israel, and no one is going to say, if they're selling equipment to Brazil or Venezuela or something, no one is going to say, I won't buy this because it's from South Africa, which they might say if they were buying fruit or other items, because the arms business isn't really afflicted with the same conscience. And so for countries like that, the arms exports can be very significant indeed. And for a country like Brazil, it can be perhaps the most significant export apart from coffee.
Well, that's bad news. I mean, in the sense that it's difficult to imagine de-accelerating this new arms race if so many governments have economies that are dependent on selling arms.
I think that that's true, and it's one of the ironic byproducts of better relations between the superpowers, that while they are destroying weapons and throwing away missiles and reducing numbers of troops, the equipment that they would normally use is going to come onto the market, and I do not believe it'll all just be destroyed. Instead, they will go out into other markets, and those other markets in turn will sell on their equipment. So you're going to have a much more competitive environment where prices will fall, where there will, if you like, be a constant yard sale of military equipment around the world. And that in turn is going to help with the proliferation. So you have two pressures, one, the new arms suppliers themselves, and two, a greater number of arms from a greater number of countries, all competing for, by and large, the same markets. So all of that seems to suggest that there will be a large number of countries be able to have more and better weapons than they've ever had in the past.
Would you have any suggestions for reversing that trend?
I think it's extremely difficult because there are a number of things that one can do. Tighten up the nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation treaty, have a chemical treaty. But all of these things only work if there are real sanctions. And sanctions in the past have never, ever worked effectively because each country that sees a possibility of earning some cash will just ignore any agreements that they've signed. So there has to be agreements agreed to and then sanctions applied. And if this country ignores the agreement, then there has to be serious penalties applied. And realistically, I don't see that actually happening. Who is going to say to Germany, because you supplied the equipment that has allowed Libya to develop a chemical weapons manufacturing capability, you can no longer sit at the table where trade is discussed? Well, that's just simply not going to happen. You can have a public opprobrium. You can have exposing it to the public. That does some good, but only for a very short time.
As a journalist, your beat is stuff that's highly secretive. You know, arms merchants, governments that don't want it known that they're building nuclear weapons, governments that don't want too many people to know how much they're exporting in terms of weapons. What's the most difficult thing about getting to the bottom of things in your job?
Well, I think the most difficult thing is getting the trust of all different parties who are involved, from the intelligence community through the arms dealers, through governments. It's extremely difficult getting people to talk about things that are, as you say, secret. I think what you have to do is to talk. You don't talk to the Iraqis about what the Iraqis are doing. You talk perhaps to the Americans or to the Brits. But then you wouldn't talk perhaps to some people in America about what the CIA are doing. You might talk to the Brits or the French. So one has to some extent to trade off one against the other, rather like the arms business itself, perhaps.
Well, James Adams, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Adams is the defense correspondent and associate editor of the Sunday Times of London. His new book is called Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, guitarist and singer Mark Knopfler. He's the founder of Dire Straits. He has another band called the Notting Hillbillies, and he's written the scores for several films, including the new film Last Exit to Brooklyn. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Tim Robbins is no dummy, but he sometimes plays one in movies. In Bull Durham, he was Nuke LaLoosh, the rookie pitcher who tries wearing a woman's garter belt as a way to improve his control. Now he's playing a crazed, gun-toting, jealous husband in the new comedy Cadillac Man. A talk with Tim Robbins coming up on Fresh Air. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the rise, fall, and rise again of blues harmonica great Sonny Boy Williamson. And commentator Patricia McLaughlin grows a garden of roses. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There was an outburst in the courtroom late this afternoon as a jury in Brooklyn, New York, found Keith Mondello not guilty of murder and manslaughter charges in the fatal shooting last year of a black teenager. Mondello was convicted of riot and weapons possession and a series of lesser charges. The most serious of these charges carry jail terms of 1 1/3 to 4 years. He had been accused of being the alleged ringleader of the gang, which killed 16-year-old Yusef Hawkins. Last night, a separate jury convicted 19-year-old Joseph Fama of second-degree murder by depraved indifference in connection with the fatal shooting. A flurry of activity on arms control today in Moscow, where Secretary of State Baker is holding his own last round of talks to prepare for this month's summit meeting. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The U.S. and Soviet sides agreed they'd made good progress today in removing remaining obstacles toward a strategic arms agreement. How much progress is still not certain, though. Marshal Sergei Akhramayev, military advisor to the Soviet president, told reporters all obstacles have been overcome. It's possible, said Akhramayev, to sign a treaty by the end of the year. That would mean Mikhail Gorbachev and President Bush might be able to cap their Washington summit by signing an agreement in principle on strategic arms. But U.S. officials cautioned that the deal isn't finished yet. Negotiators are still at work tonight, and Baker says he'll extend his trip beyond tomorrow's scheduled departure. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
In Washington, the government has released another 1,200 pages of the personal notebooks of Iran-Contra figure Oliver North. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
North kept notes of virtually all of his meetings and conversations. One such meeting was with former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega in London in September 1986. North and Noriega plotted commando training and operations against Nicaragua, even after U.S. officials knew that Noriega was involved in drugs and arms trafficking. Tom Blatton is deputy director of the National Security Archive in Washington.
For 20 years, the United States cut deals with Noriega. The key question is, did the officials who cut those deals know that Washington was in bed with a devil? The Oliver North notebooks answer that question by saying yes.
Researchers at the National Security Archive now have some 2,600 pages of North's notes. They believe there exists another 200 they have not seen yet. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Also in Washington, a new federal grand jury has been convened to continue the 3.5-year-old criminal probe of the Iran-Contra scandal. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 12 points to close at 2,819.91. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There were actually two Sonny Boy Williamsons, and both were blues harmonica players in the 1940s. One was killed, and the other went on to stardom. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward untangles this bizarre story and tells us about the life of the hard-drinking, hard-living bluesman who became the greater musician of the two.
There was an animal called a goat. He butted his way out of the Supreme Court, so let him go. Yes, and let him go. Cause he butts so hard till they can't use him in our coat no more.
The Goat. That was one of Sonny Boy Williamson's nicknames. And if you've ever tried to deal with an obstinate goat, you've got a clue why Sonny Boy's friends called him that. He was so stubborn that he insisted that he was the original Sonny Boy Williamson. true. He was older than the other one. He was born sometime during the 1890s in rural Mississippi. But it was the younger, John Lee Williamson, who made his name in Chicago in the mid-30s and recorded as Sonny Boy Williamson on RCA's Bluebird label. One night, coming home from a club engagement with $40 in his pocket, John Lee Williamson was robbed and slashed to death in a Chicago alley, his story over at the age of 34. Down in the Mississippi Delta, the other Sonny Boy, whose real name might have been Willie Williams or Rice Miller, heard the news. He'd been using the name Sonny Boy because of his daily radio show, The King Biscuit Show, on KFFA from Helena, Arkansas, where he sold Sonny Boy flour, a brand that still exists. He knew it was past time to act, so he got in touch with Lillian McMurray, whose Trumpet Records label was looking for talent. She dispatched a man with a portable recording unit, and here's what he got.
Your woman, I wish to God, man, that you could see mine. You talking about your woman, I wish to God that you could see mine. Every time the little girl starts to love me, she bring eyesight to the blind. Thought her daddy must have been a millionaire.
Trumpet didn't have the distribution to make Eyesight to the Blind a national hit, but blues fans in the South bought as many copies as they could get their hands on. Not long afterwards, Sonny Boy gave them another classic.
Ain't that a pity? People ain't got a crying shame. Ain't that a pity? I declare it's a crying shame. She waited till I got 9 below 0 and put me down for another man. I give her all my money.
Nobody had ever heard a harmonica played like that, not even by the first Sonny Boy. And once these records started getting played on the radio, Sonny Boy Williamson became even more of a star than his radio show had made him. Trumpet made enough money to improve its distribution and started 1952 with a top 10 rhythm and blues hit by another Mississippi Delta star, Elmore James. Sonny Boy sat in on harmonica.
I'm gonna get up in the morning, I believe I dust my room.
By now, Sonny Boy knew that he had to do what John Lee Williamson had done, and in 1954 he moved north to Milwaukee. Chess Records, the unquestioned ruler of the Chicago blues scene, heard that Sonny Boy was living close by, and late in 1955 they recorded him.
Well, I'm going down the roads and stopping Fannie Mae. Gonna tell Fanny what I heard. A boyfriend said, don't stop me talking. I'll tell everything I know. I'm gonna break up this single fight, cause somebody's got to go. Jack give his wife $2.
What was becoming evident was that besides a completely unique harmonica style, Sonny Boy was a very unusual songwriter. Very few of his trumpet records, and even fewer of the sides he did for Chess, fall back on the usual blues cliches, and sometimes he could be downright bizarre in his imagery.
It took me a long time to find out my mistake. It took me a long time to find out my mistake. It sure did, man.
But I bet you my bottom dollar I'm not fighting no more fall for snakes.
In the early 60s, when he was 65, Sonny Boy was invited to join the American Folk Blues Festival, a show that toured Europe just as young people there were beginning to fall in love with blues. As he wiggled his tall, skinny body while coaxing unheard-of sounds from his harmonica, Sonny Boy won them over. And when the rest of the review went back to the U.S., Sonny Boy stayed on in London, where youngsters who would soon become the Yardbirds and other British invasion groups fought each other to back him up. Those youngsters in England want to play the blues so bad, Sonny Boy remarked later. And you know, they play the blues so bad. Wearing a Savile Row suit and a derby, Sonny Boy returned to America in 1964 and resumed his King Biscuit broadcasts in Helena, Arkansas. People in the juke joints loved his clothes, but didn't believe him when he said he'd gotten them in England, and he didn't care. He knew his time wasn't long, and he died on May 26, 1965. In the end, he won. When you say Sonny Boy Williamson these days, nobody thinks of John Lee.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Tim Robbins is best known for his winning portrayal of the dim-witted pitcher Nuke LaLoosh in the comedy Bull Durham. The more serious Tim Robbins has his roots in theater, particularly in experimental theater in Los Angeles, where he's been writing, directing, and producing since 1981. In the new film Cadillac Man, Robbins again plays a guy who's not quite with it. Robin Williams stars as a fast-talking Cadillac salesman. Tim Robbins plays Larry, the crazed husband of the showroom's pretty young secretary. Larry thinks one of the salesmen is having an affair with his wife. In a jealous rage, he decides to take everyone hostage. In this scene, Williams is talking to the police on the phone while Robbins is holding a gun to his head.
He wants to know what you want, Larry.
What?
He wants to know what you want.
I told him already. I want him to go away.
He wants you to go away.
Yeah, that's very funny. What does he want?
He says it's not on the program, Larry.
Well, what am I going to do? Oh, what am I going to do?
He's a little up in the air right now. Can you give him a few minutes?
Who was cast first in Cadillac Man, you or Robin Williams?
Robin.
And was he one of the reasons that you wanted to sign? I mean, was he used to convince you to sign up?
Well, absolutely. I really was at once frightened and incredibly excited about working with him. Frightened for the obvious reasons of you know, being in the situation where you're being trounced on by another actor and excited by the challenge of working with such an incredible mind and insane talent. And all my fears were pretty much unfounded because he's a very generous actor and doesn't trounce at all and, in fact, takes you along with him.
How much improvisation was there from take to take?
Well, we would do about five or six takes of the script, and then once we had gotten that, start to go off into tangents, oftentimes going off into some strange orbit in some strange galaxy. It's great to work with Robin because anything can come out, and you have to just expect it and fly with it. And I learned a great deal from him about trusting your mind to go where it wants to go.
Can you give a sense of how a moment or a scene changed from the script and evolved into, you know, something interestingly different?
There's a scene by the door where, well, I have the gun to his head most of the time, or his back at least, and I'm trying to tell the police to go away, and they're asking me what my name is, and I don't want to give them my real name. And that whole section is pretty much improvised,
This scene that you're talking about when the actor, when your character doesn't want to give his real name, Robin Williams starts suggesting names and the character starts suggesting names and there's this big back and forth kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a, he says, I say Chip, he says that sounds like a squirrel. And then he says Charlie, and I say that sounds like a Chinese communist, and on and on and on. It's much funnier when you see it. It's very hard to describe funny moments.
You know, I have to tell you, I've seen the coming attractions for Cadillac Man on TV. And from the coming attractions, I assumed I probably wouldn't like it. And I went to see the movie last night, and I thought it was really very funny, very entertaining. Do you ever get bugged by the way films are sold?
Oh, boy. Oh, no, not at all. I think they do wonderful jobs all the time, Terry. What might make you ask something like that? I think that marketing is just a absolutely unfathomable concept for me, so I try not to get involved with it.
Right. Let me ask you some things about your background. You grew up in Greenwich Village. Your father was a folk singer.
Uh-huh.
Did you like his music? What kind of music did he play?
He was in a group called the Highwaymen.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wait, what were their hits?
Michael Row Your Boat Ashore.
Oh, yeah.
And Cotton Fields.
Oh, no.
Oh, when them cotton fields, the falls get rotten. Yeah, it was fun. I remember that was probably the first time I ever understood what the dynamic between performer and audience could be. And, you know, I saw some pretty special things happen. You know, it might sound corny now in our jaded sensibilities of the 90s, but, you know, it was really great to see a performer lead an audience in song.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of inspiring, you know. It was taking people that had nothing to do with each other or didn't know each other and uniting them in some kind of poetry. That was kind of special.
Did you sing along?
Oh, sure, yeah.
So were you often backstage, or were you in the audience?
I was in the audience. I remember, I guess my dad brought me up on stage when I was about 6 for the first time, and I sang The Ink is Black, The Page is White, a place called the Cafe Lena in Saratoga, New York.
Did you ever think that you'd become a singer?
No. Maybe for a few months when I was 6, right after the Cafe Lena.
Right. You organized a theater group called The Gang.
The Actors Gang.
The Actors Gang.
Yes.
Is the group still together?
You can call them The Gang, though, because we do. You know, it's kind of the shorthand for it.
Is the group still together, and do you still work with them?
Yes. Last year we toured as the American representative for the Edinburgh International Festival with a play called Carnage. And after Edinburgh, we went to New York at the Public Theater. And recently they've been working without me on a show called The Lower Depths by Maxim Gorky. Do you know it?
No, I don't.
It's a... Well, a rollicking comedy. No, not at all. It's it's actually very poignant for today. It was written around 1900, and has a lot to do with the homeless situation and the tragedy of that. It's set in kind of a flop house in Russia in 1900.
One of the ways that you funded the Actors Gang early on in your career is with the money you made working in television and B-movies. What are some of the B-movies that we might have missed that you were in?
B stands for before. B stands for, I don't know. Let's see. I can't even remember them. It's funny you should mention them. No. It's funny, you know, writers can screw up, directors can screw up, do movies that are terrible and be forgotten. But the actors, there's this new invention called cable TV that keeps these nightmares coming right back at you.
Oh.
So, you know, all you have to do is look in a cable guide and you'll be able to find these and the titles of those films.
But you'd rather not help us find them.
Nah, why? Why publicize a bad film?
On the other hand, are there movies that you've made that you really would like people to see that weren't in distribution theatrically very long that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I think Five Corners is a very interesting, eccentric movie. I'm proud of my work in that.
And for people who've only seen you in either Bull Durham or Bull Durham and Cadillac Man, it'll show a really different side of you as an actor.
Yeah, it's a...
You want to describe the character?
Well, yeah, he has a brain. he's a very committed... this is a man that grew up in the Bronx and grew up in a very physical way in his neighborhood, the neighborhood bully until a certain point in his life. And something about his father's death and the words of Martin Luther King started to ring true to him, and he started to take action in his own life to study pacifism as a means to change. And in the movie, he's about to go down to Mississippi to register people for the vote. It's set in 1964.
It's a good performance.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there an actor you most admire? You know, whose kind of career you'd most like to have?
You know, I was like, you know, like 3 weeks ago, I thought of that question, and I had a perfect answer for it. Now I can't remember. There's a lot of actors I admire, but you know, I guess I really want to be Bertolt Brecht. I mean, he wasn't an actor, but you know. He was such a great writer, and
you'd like to have that impact on theater of kind of rethinking what theater is, what impact it should have on the audience,
and also to be able to create theater that is not only entertaining but is about ideas and raises important questions about the time we're living in.
I guess there's an obvious irony here that in your new film you're playing the screwball, and in real life you want to like rethink the meaning of theater.
Yeah, I guess that is pretty ironic, but one hand feeds the other, as I say. You know, it's like I wouldn't be able to do the theater without the movies. I wouldn't be able to produce the Actors Gang, certainly, without the income that the movies generate. You know, I have fun doing both.
Thanks a lot for talking
with fun.
Us. Yeah.
I have fun. I have lots of fun.
Tim Robbins co-stars in the new comedy Cadillac Man. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. My colleague Robert Siegel talks with the new president of Hungary, who's in Washington for an official visit. We'll have a report on the election Sunday in Romania. There's a great fear in Bucharest and around the country that the communists who were involved at high levels in the Ceausescu government will be in effective control of any government that might emerge. There's a report the Soviet space station leaves the cosmonauts there without a reliable means of return. John Burnett tells us from Texas that the killer bees are about to come across the border from Mexico. Also, the music and folklore of the group known as Three Mustafas Three. It's music from most everywhere.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Patricia McLaughlin usually comments for us on the latest trends and absurdities in fashion, but today her thoughts are on her garden.
3 years ago, I planted this old French rose in my backyard. Ever since, I've been waiting to see what it would look like. Its name is Souvenir du Docteur Jamin, and this morning it bloomed for the first time. It's exactly the shade of a Victorian love seat, a deep maroon, with frilled petals like silk velvet, and a thrilling fragrance. Honorine de Brabant came out the day before, producing one perfect rose striped bright pink on light pink, something that until this week I'd only seen in books. These are exciting days in the backyard. Hamburger Phoenix exploded across the back wall a few days ago. I counted 32 silky cherry red blossoms this morning. And there are 4 more climbers loaded with fat buds, ready to go any minute. I've been bragging about my roses to everybody I know this week. And now you, as if I were personally responsible for all this gorgeousness. although at the same time I suspect most of it's luck. One thing you learn from gardening is how little control you really have. It's like life that way, only more so. You can do everything by the book, and still your daylilies can be eaten by slugs or your roses decimated by canker. Last year, for instance, most of these roses never even bloomed. I'd sent soil samples to the Agricultural Extension, and they said my soil had way too much phosphorus and nowhere near enough nitrogen. So I added a lot of nitrogen, which may be why I ended up with lots of green leaves and stems and no flowers at all. I'm never sure, though. You really need to be a scientist to understand the technology that's for sale at your local garden center, not to mention the exotic stuff you can order from the back pages of the gardening magazines. Fertilizers, soil flocculators, trace elements, a million kinds of pesticides, all sorts of weird potions guaranteed to make your tomatoes twice as big. Letting me loose with all that chemistry is like letting your kid drive the space shuttle. It's all magic to me. But there's something about gardening that makes magic seem plausible. Black magic, sometimes. I mean, as some perceptive person wrote in a magazine a couple of weeks ago, if your hobby is decorating and you've just got your living room exactly where you want it, you don't have to worry about coming home some night to find that your perfect new sofa has turned black and shriveled up and that the coffee table has been eaten by Japanese beetles. But that happens in the garden all the time. I've planted hundreds of expensive perennials in my backyard, which is only a little bigger than a number 10 envelope. The only reason there's still room for a few more is that most of them die. Some die right away. Some hang around looking depressed for a while and just don't come back the next year. Gardening, you're right up against Darwinian nature, red in tooth and claw. Aphids, red spiders, black spot, botrytis, scale, drought, poor drainage, wrong pH, wrong fertilizer, a million kind of weeds, slugs the size of dinosaurs. It's a jungle out there. Half the time you never know what hit you. Which makes these roses seem all the more miraculous. You buy a rose for around $7. It's a scrawny little thing. All gnarled roots and a couple of twiggy little canes. It looks like nothing. You dig a hole, toss in some peat moss, throw in the rose, water it in, ignore it for a couple of years, and then one spring, wham! It's the way the reward is out of all proportion to the investment that makes it seem like magic. The way you get something truly, astonishingly wonderful for practically nothing.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. Our production assistants are Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tuohy, and Allison Dufty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with songwriter, guitarist, and the founder of Dire Straits, Mark Knopfler. Also, filmmaker Michael Romer tells us why it took 20 years for his movie, The Plot Against Harry, to make it to theaters. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
WHYY FM, Philadelphia.